This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Yesterday, State Supreme Court Justice Menas Ketchum submitted a letter of resignation to Governor Jim Justice. Ketchum's stepping down from the bench comes as the entire West Virginia Supreme Court is under investigation for possible impeachment. And today, the House Judiciary Committee resumes meetings on that very issue. As committee members make their way to Charleston for the next round of meetings, West Virginia Public Broadcasting News Director Jesse Wright sat down with senior reporter Dave Mistich to discuss Ketchum's resignation and how these meetings are expected to play out.
Dave, thanks for joining us. So we got news that Supreme Court Justice Menas Ketchum is now resigning. What are your thoughts on that?
He submitted a letter of resignation to Governor Justice. It was just two sentences, handwritten. That was faxed to the governor's office, and it just said very simply, "I have decided to retire and relinquish my office as a justice of the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals. My retirement is effective at the close of business day on Friday, July 27th. So his resignation came with a lot of a focus on Justice Laufrey. However, Ketchum himself also was under scrutiny. The legislative auditor's report showed that he had used a state vehicle for private use. Included in that were some personal golf trips. Part of the hang-up on all this was that he didn't report this use of a state vehicle on his personal income taxes. He did repay the state more than $1,500 for incorrect travel expenses. The interesting part about this is the Democrats, with all the focus on Laufrey, the Democrats have been calling for a speedy impeachment to hit this trigger date for a special election for that seat. But with Ketchum's resignation now, coming before that 84-day mark before the election, we will see a special election for Ketchum's seat. With all of this, you know, attention on the Supreme Court, Justice Ketchum went ahead and resigned, you know, just a day ahead of these meetings with the House Judiciary Committee.
So with this resignation, the House Judiciary Committee is going to get to its work this morning, and it's going to begin investigating the other justices. How can we expect that to play out?
Well, you know, right now we're at the point to where this committee has been, and its staff has been collecting evidence. You know, the legislative auditor's reports on the Supreme Court have been public for a while. They're also taking a look at the Judicial Investigations Commission, their statement of charges against Justice Laufrey. They have issued a subpoena to some officials with the Judicial Investigations Commission. And I spoke to House Judiciary Chair John Schott, and he explained a little bit about how this process is going to play out.
The JIC has its own procedures for what information it can release. For instance, the information that they may be developing on other subjects of their investigation that have not resulted in charges, they cannot release any of that information. It's totally confidential. So they have a process by which their board has to approve the release of any information, and then their counsel has to review it and basically redact from it or eliminate from what they develop any information that's still preserved by confidentiality.
And as Delegate Schott pointed out there, they're looking at a whole slew of sources for information in this investigation. They, like I said, they have issued a subpoena. I believe that this round, you know, today, tomorrow, and Saturday is going to be focused mostly on the legislative auditor's report. I've spoken to a lot of delegates on this House Judiciary Committee, and that's what they're expecting, you know, this weekend as far as these proceedings go.
So do we have a timeline for this process and really any idea of how long it might take?
The House Judiciary Committee has scheduled meetings, of course, this weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, as well as next weekend, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. They are blocking off two additional weeks beyond that as well with those same days. But as a lot of people have brought up, you know, the Democrats have been pushing for this to happen quickly, to hit that August 14th date for a vacancy, to get that special election. But I talked to Delegate Schott, and he stressed the importance of taking time and being very careful in this process.
Keep in mind, this is not a parking ticket situation. The result of this could be the removal of duly elected officials that thousands, tens of thousands of West Virginians voted to place in a position of trust and responsibility for a term of 12 years. So it needs to be given serious consideration. It shouldn't be a knee-jerk reaction.
So the state constitution doesn't provide a whole lot of guidance on the specifics on how the process plays out. What exactly does this look like, and what might we expect in terms of the process going forward?
Well, Chairman Schott has appointed what are known as impeachment managers, including himself. There are additionally two Republicans and two Democrats that are going to be guiding this process through the committee as well as through the full House and into a trial in the Senate if and when that comes to be. I spoke to WVU constitutional law professor Bob Bastris about this process and exactly how unclear it is in the state constitution.
There's just so little to go on. I mean, the constitution is specific. The House, the legislature has to be in session when the House impeaches.
Right, which is why the special session was called to initiate the possibility of impeachment.
Exactly. And it doesn't have to be in session for the Senate to convict.
Right.
And that's all the Constitution says. And that's all we have to go on. And none of the other issues are specified, and I think the legislature could do what they want.
And so as this plays out, as we've noted, there isn't a lot of precedent for impeachment here in the state of West Virginia, and certainly not on the Supreme Court and you know, justices of the Supreme Court, and absolutely certainly not when all five state Supreme Court justices are named in a resolution for possible impeachment. With Ketchum out, obviously the focus is now even more so on Justice Laufrey. It's my understanding that they're going to be looking at this one by one, justice by justice, to see if there was any conduct that would constitute impeachable offenses. So, you know, this committee will roll on. They will continue their investigation. Once, if and when they have, you know, come to the conclusion that impeachment is the route they want to take, they will draw up articles of impeachment. They will send that to the full House to be voted on. And if and when that happens, the trial or trials would take place in the Senate. The Senate needs 23 votes to convict and remove a person from public office. So a very long process ahead of us. Not a lot of guidance, as we pointed out. But I think that, you know, these impeachment managers, they'll be tasked with setting the framework as all this moves forward.
Well, it's fascinating stuff and certainly uncharted territory. So I look forward to seeing your coverage from down in Charleston. And we'll see how this plays out in the next couple of weeks. Thanks a lot for joining us, Dave.
Thanks, Jesse.
This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:52. Areas of fog this morning, becoming mostly sunny, high temperatures in the 80s. Clear skies tonight with lows in the 60s, and mostly sunny Friday with highs in the 80s and low 90s. Support for the weather forecast is provided by Erie Insurance, putting service first since 1925. Local agents available at erieinsurance.com. And by the Charleston Gazette Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather alerts, keeping you in the know while you're on the go. Local libraries offer everything from books and movies to online access and even downloadable music. But should they also stock the drug Narcan? Some library systems in our region are considering whether they should have a supply of the overdose medication on hand, along with other ways to serve the community. As part of an Idea Stream series exploring the ripple effects of the opioid crisis, David C. Barnett surveyed a cross-section of Northeast Ohio libraries.
In December of 2016, a man walked into the Willoughby Eastlake Public Library and collapsed.
We know it was heroin.
Lori Kazat manages communications and development for Willoughby Eastlake in Lake County, just east of Cuyahoga.
And our staff members called 911, and the paramedics and police came, and they had to give him several doses of Narcan to have him become alert again.
A number of library systems in cities ranging from Philadelphia to San Francisco have begun stocking and getting training in the use of Narcan, the brand name for the overdose antidote naloxone. But none of the 18 libraries we surveyed had any immediate plans to keep a supply of the medication in-house. Lori Kazat says some staff members have balked at administering anything close to medical treatment.
What if the person laying on the floor isn't a drug addict and they just administered Narcan? You know, can they get in trouble for that? Is the person going to be mad? You know, what? It's not up to us to make a medical diagnosis.
But a number of area libraries have had staff trained by local law enforcement and drug experts to help spot people with problems. Anastasia Diamond-Ortiz is director of the Lorain Public Library System, which serves over a half dozen communities and townships to the west of Cleveland. She saw clues about the growing opioid crisis, but didn't recognize them at the time.
You know, we would be finding, like, drug paraphernalia here and there. We would be having to actually lock restroom doors, which was completely unusual for us.
But Diamond-Ortiz says her wake-up call came after a branch librarian asked to organize an opioid information program in Columbia Township.
So she actually got together an event, just kind of seeing, okay, well, I wonder if anyone will be interested in this, and got somebody from the Sheriff's Department from Lorain County to come, and thinking, oh, maybe a few people will show up. We don't know what'll happen. But it ended up being so popular that it's a group that's continued on.
The Mentor Public Library, east of Cleveland, has plans to help rid local households of unused prescription painkillers that often accumulate in home medicine cabinets. Mentor Executive Director Cheryl Quonan says her library is preparing to distribute Datira Ziploc bags that deactivate drugs to patrons.
And what they do is you put your unused old pills in there, and there's a chemical reaction that happens that deactivates them and makes them safe to throw away.
Mentor's one of at least three local libraries planning to stock Datira bags. Willoughby East Lake Director Rick Werner says all these reactions to the opioid epidemic are part of a new normal for libraries.
We're in some respects during the day a senior services organization because our libraries are full of senior citizens. After school, we become an informal after school program. In the evenings, we're homework centers. So I think we very much recognize, and we're not alone in this as a public library, that we've got obligations beyond just information provision.
And he says it's not surprising that libraries have been touched by the overdose crisis, but he thinks they can play a key role in helping to find a solution.
We're probably one of the last public institutions that's open as many hours as we are and have absolutely no barriers to entry. And I think with that openness and accessibility comes responsibility for us to make sure that we are as responsive to the needs of the community as we possibly can be.
David C. Barnett brought us that story, reporting from member station IdeaStream out of Cleveland. The U.S. Attorney for Kentucky's Western District announced 8 conspiracy indictments yesterday against employees of the bankrupt Armstrong Energy Coal Company for falsifying dust monitoring samples of 2 of its Kentucky mines. The indictments against safety directors, section foremen, and a supervisor at the mines come as black lung cases are surging in the region. U.S. Attorney Russell Coleman says officials rely on the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration to ensure companies comply with dust controls. But he says it's important that people working in the mines report on violations.
But at the end of the day, those that want to cheat in a complex industry like that will always attempt to cheat. So the best witnesses, the best sources of information are the miners themselves.
Acting on a tip from whistleblowers, federal inspectors found violations at Armstrong Energy's Parkway and Kronos mines. Mike Wilson, a former miner at Armstrong Mines, was among those who alerted inspectors. Wilson says cheating on dust samples was common at many mines and that miners had little choice in the matter.
I done it at all of them. Tampered with the dust pump at all of them. You had to do it their way. If you didn't, you didn't stay.
Wilson says he now has black lung. The indictment lists the Armstrong Company as an unindicted co-conspirator, and Coleman did not rule out further indictments. Coleman says the Armstrong Coal Company avoided implementing ventilation and production controls to save money. That came at the expense of exposing the miners, increasing their risks of contracting black lung. Armstrong Energy owned the mines in Kentucky's Ohio and Muhlenberg counties, which supplied coal to power plants, including the Tennessee Valley Authority's Paradise Station. Armstrong Energy declared bankruptcy last year. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.